It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Community-supported agriculture is a growing movement that partners local farms with local consumers who purchase a share in the season's harvest. Join in with your questions and thoughts as the CSA sign-up window nears its end and the delivery season approaches. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tony Schultz is the owner of Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin. The farm has operated a CSA program for nearly 20 years. Tony, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Why should people purchase CSA boxes? Why is it so important?
I think CSA is a great way for people to connect where their food comes from. And it helps make our food system in general more just, more sustainable, more democratic, and more fun. It's a great way to receive organic food. It's a great way to support the local community. And it's a great way to get the best and freshest food possible in terms of food that's harvested at the peak of season, that is seasonal, that is the ripest and freshest it could possibly be. It's harvested the day before and delivered to your neighborhood the next day or the day of. So it's great, fresh, seasonal, organic produce delivered to your neighborhood.
Something you just said really stuck out to me. You said making it more democratic. How so?
It allows people to have a choice of where their food comes from, but also to bring the economy back down to a local level. The most impact that we can have in a democratic system is at the local level, like Tip O'Neill said, right? All politics is local.
Sure.
And so that involves local food. If you want to impact the food system because you're concerned about how food affects human health or how it affects the environment or how it affects the economy, putting your dollar into the hands of people in your community is the best way to have an impact on that.
The UW-Madison Center for Integrated Agriculture System says that CSAs can cost the same or be more affordable than purchasing fresh vegetables elsewhere. Do you find that to be true? And can you spell out the affordability of CSA programs?
Definitely. I think because CSA has so many different food options coming to you, like about 40 different food types in a typical CSA season from the beginning to the end, some of the staples that you could get at a grocery store are more affordable at a grocery store, like potatoes, onions, maybe. But if you want to diversify your diet away from those staples, things that are harder to get are definitely more affordable at farmers market or a CSA, like parsnips or salad turnips. Mm-hmm. Interesting food that your CSA can help you navigate in cooking and eating. And so I think the cost, because also it's easier to organize for a CSA farmer. So whatever's coming in season, I get to put in that box. And that helps make it more affordable. I'm not doing the work of sorting and selecting and meeting a specific market need. So that helps make it more affordable as well.
There's a guide for CSA farmers that's been produced by North Carolina State University that says CSA members prefer familiar vegetables and only a small amount of exotic produce. In your experience, do you agree with that guidance, or do you find that people really enjoy having more of a variety?
I generally agree with that guidance. Yes, you want to keep your box based on providing staples. But I also think people, when they encounter a vegetable that you can help them facilitate in, like getting familiar with and using, for instance, salad turnips, this is not something that's going to show up in a lot of grocery stores, but I have introduced this. It's one of my favorite things to grow because I love introducing it to people, like curry turnips or salad turnips, and providing recipes for that. And people become hooked on it and they're into it. And so it's a way to help people break out of their dietary rut. And that can be a revelatory, exciting experience. Well, so yeah, staples are tomatoes, potatoes, carrots, right? The iconic vegetables are important. But these special vegetables are the fun part of CSA.
Well, you get those fun, interesting vegetables that you're not familiar with. What do you tell people about how to use them? Do you include things with the box saying, here's a few uses for them? Or what should people do when they get something and they're like, I've never tried this before?
Yes, I've produced a weekly newsletter, and most CSAs do that. And they all often revolve around news from the farm and a couple of recipes. So I will base my recipes on the more obscure items in the box or different ways of using things of staples as well. So if I do have salad, turnips, or fennel in, I make sure to have my recipes based on those things that people aren't as familiar with.
We are talking about community-supported agriculture, and the enrollment season is going on right now as warmer temperatures are on the way. Our guest is Tony Schultz. He is owner of Stony Acres Farm in Athens. If you have questions or comments on CSAs, join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. For consumers who want the satisfaction of supporting local agriculture and they want to know where their food is coming from, community-supported agriculture can be an attractive option. If you already buy a CSA share, what are you looking forward to this year? And if this is something you're considering, what do you want to know? Call in anytime with your questions or your thoughts on CSAs, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We are talking with farmer and business owner Tony Schultz from Central Wisconsin. He's a third-generation farmer. I'm curious, Tony, if consumer preferences and tastes have kind of shifted over the years. You've been doing this a long time. Are the boxes you're putting together now different markedly from, say, 10 years ago?
I would say my boxes are more refined and slightly more diverse. As you know, as you gain experience in any industry, you're able to add things around the margins and grow. So some things I've put in the last 10 years is I've done wheat, and I've ground that into flour, and I've tried different varieties of things around the margins. And so that's what I think changing around the margins is what I've focused on.
For farmers, what are some of the pros and cons of supplementing CSA boxes with items from other farms? For instance, I know that some farms, produce farms, want to add meat to their CSA offerings, and so they partner with another business. Do you do that, or, I mean, would you?
I have done it in the past. It's an effort of coordination, and I think it can help make the box more interesting and appealing. We've added on eggs in the past and have done coffee. I'm currently not doing any add-ons, but if you're interested in add-ons, that's something you can search for when you're selecting the CSA farm you'd like to be a part of.
You connect with customers in a bunch of different ways. You've got the pizza night on the farm. You've got the newsletters that you talked about earlier. How important is that engagement with customers for your business?
That is the great part of it. It puts the community in community-supported agriculture. And that's what makes the food system less anonymous and strengthens the community. I've made some of my good friends over the course of the year of years of doing CSA have come from doing worker shares or being regulars at the farmer's market or at Pizza on the Farm. And so I have made a lot of valuable connections to people and cultivated important relationships in my life because of our connection through the food and community supported agriculture in other ways.
Well, it sounds like that face-to-face interaction is really beneficial for you and for the customers. I know you're at the farmers market of Wausau regularly. Do you also use that as an opportunity to educate customers on farming or on healthy eating?
Oh, definitely. I think one of the ways to deal with that as a consumer, as an eater, is to focus on cooking. And at the farmer's market and at Pizza on the Farm and through the CSA, I'm just constantly talking about cooking. I think if you're thinking about food in a way where you have to prepare it, you're going to ask other questions like, is it organic or not? Or what impact does this have on the environment? What impact does this have on local community? What impact does this have on my health? So if you're cooking and not just ingesting random calories, I think that's going to go a long way into delivering on the promises of, you know, a more just, a healthier, sustainable food system.
We're talking about community-supported agriculture in Wisconsin with Tony Schultz. He is the owner of Stony Acres Farm in Athens. Your farm became a certified organic farm in 2009. We hear organic a lot, but what does that really mean, a certified organic farm, and why was it so important to you?
I think that I deliver the definition to people as a way of saying organic is you cannot use synthetic pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and it also involves a commitment to demonstrating a constant improvement of soil health. That's my shorthand for an organic definition. And in order to be in the Fair Share CSA Coalition, which is the biggest CSA coalition in the state and the country in Wisconsin, you have to be a certified organic farm. And it's something that we've debated, but it's still important to us because it verifies health claims about not having synthetic pesticides and herbicides in our food. And it verifies our commitment to professionalism as produce farmers and CSA farmers. So it is important and for giving consumers a peace of mind when you're looking to connect with a farm.
I have to wonder about weather. You know, we hear a lot about climate change and an increase in severe weather events. And as a farmer, I mean, you're somewhat at the mercy of Mother Nature here. How are you coping with climate change? And what do you do when you have a summer that the weather just does not cooperate?
Exactly. Well, farmers and the weather, that's a long story. I take all of my anxiety and I blast it into the atmosphere. And then I hope that it rains at the right time. I tell people all I want is an inch of rain every Sunday morning from midnight to 6 a.m. That's all I ask for. But what do I do? Here is the trick. And this is the great thing about CSA is diversity. And so many CSAs are small farms that grow many varieties of things and have other projects around the margins. So people ask me, what is the most important crop you raise? And I say, it's diversity. It's having lots of different things. So if something fails, or if the season is hard on one thing, or the timing doesn't work out because of inclement weather at the wrong time, you have other things to take its place. Diversity, diversity, diversity is the way of dealing with the problems of climate change, which can especially impact volatility of seasons. That's how I think of the main impacts of climate change, is the problems of volatility in agriculture when you expect a season to go a certain way, but the peaks and valleys are more severe. And how the seasonal shifts that can happen, especially around the transition seasons. Like right now in March, yesterday it was below zero at my house.
Yeah.
And it's March 29th and I want to get my carrots in the ground. Right. Come on. But I'm just going to focus on things that can handle it. I'm going to focus on working in my hoop houses. And when the opportunity arises, I'm going to be ready to go.
I'm curious about the quantities in each CSA box. If you're new to this, and I'm new to this, how do you plan? How much is in a box? If you've got a family of two, should you get just one box? If you have a family of four, is that going to be enough for you? Or maybe should you get two?
Yeah, this is part of the selection process of getting a CSA. So generally for a couple, I say, you know, there's different share sizes. So I always say a small family share, which is about 60% or 70% of the produce that you would get in a traditional full share that you'd get delivered every week. But if you have a family, you want to get a full share. And that's generally the recommendations I make. But what I do is I harvest an amount that shows up in cookbooks like asparagus through zucchini, or some of Deborah Madison's, you know, farm to table books, or the New York Times cookbook says serves four, serve six. Mm-hmm. And I provide an amount that is the basis of those recipes, and you work backwards from there. So like this many carrots, this many tomatoes, and I work backwards from that amount. So a standard recipe is that say serve four, serve six, and work to include that amount in my box. And then I have recipes based on those amounts.
When do you expect the first shares to be delivered? Typically, I mean, well, you said it was below zero, so it probably depends on the weather.
Right. A traditional CSA seasons go from June through October, and we usually try to hit the first Thursday in June, which is June 1st this year. And I always tell my subscribers and farm members that I'm aiming for June 1st, but we might have to shift the season back.
Sure.
And I probably do that about half the years that I've been doing it, is I'll shift the whole season back. And so we'll go in the second week of June. And that window with the ascending light usually provides enough time to, you know, ensure a full box for people from
well,
the beginning.
We are sure looking forward to it. Our time is short. Thank you so much for joining us, Tony. Tony is the owner of Stony Acres Farm in Athens. The farm has a CSA program and has had one for nearly 20 years. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. Wisconsin's Supreme Court elections were once obscure, low turnout affairs. Otherwise reliable voters often stayed home. Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz is doing everything she can to prevent that this year, and she's getting a big assist from the Democratic Party. As Sean Johnson reports, Protasiewicz has been open about her personal beliefs on issues that could become before the court.
On a Saturday night in March, people lined up down the block outside the Barrymore Theater on Madison's East Side. The featured act that night, a live recording of the national show Pod Save America, was in town to bring attention to Wisconsin's Supreme Court race. At the front of the line is Madison resident Ariel Hendrickson, who says the election boils down to two issues.
Abortion rights and making sure that gerrymandering does not get any worse in our state.
Person after person says the same thing. And Sheila Hosseini of Madison says people understand the stakes of the race, which could flip the court from a conservative to a liberal majority for the first time in 15 years.
Probably. I mean, I know people keep saying this, but this is probably one of the most important elections for Wisconsin, especially because reproductive rights are on the line.
Protasiewicz says she decided to run for the court precisely because it's so important. Prior to being a judge, she spent decades as a Milwaukee County prosecutor. Whoever wins Wisconsin's Supreme Court race will likely hear a challenge to the state's pre-Civil War abortion ban. Protasiewicz is facing former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly. He's backed by Republicans and endorsed by the state's three anti-abortion groups.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Judge Janet Protasiewicz.
During a brief interview in front of a packed theater at the Pod Save America recording, Protasiewicz is asked what kind of difference she could make on abortion rights if she wins.
So I'll tell you this. I have been very, very forthright that my personal value is that women have a right to choose.
She's also asked about Wisconsin's Republican-drawn legislative districts. Protasiewicz calls the maps rigged. And she adds,
I would certainly welcome the opportunity to have a fresh look at our maps.
The Democratic voters in this auditorium know her message, possibly because they've had a chance to hear it everywhere. Protasiewicz has shattered campaign fundraising records thanks to millions of dollars in transfers from the state Democratic Party. That same night, party chair Ben Wickler frames the stakes in presidential terms. He asks Democrats to imagine it's election night in 2024. The eyes of the nation are on swing state Wisconsin. A lawsuit is filed, and the court's conservative majority stops the count.
And record scratch, freeze frame, you think to yourself, in 2023, I had a chance to stop this guy from getting on the Supreme Court and casting that deciding vote.
There are those who think the level of political drama playing out in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is inappropriate. Former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske was appointed to the court in 1993 and won election in 1994. She thinks court races have gotten too political and says both sides are to blame.
You know, historically, when we ran, and I ran a long time ago, we wouldn't go anywhere near talking about an issue that might come before the court.
Kelly has been far more guarded about sharing his personal views. He argues Protasiewicz crossed a line by sharing hers. Supreme Court races are still technically nonpartisan, but people who show up to see Protasiewicz in Madison are okay with the way she talks about the race. Carol Drysdale says it's a nice idea that a justice could be completely objective.
That someone can leave behind everything that they are and everything that they have experienced and lived through and just leave it all at the door and be completely objective. But that's not how human beings work.
Drysdale says there's more at stake in this race than just purely judicial matters. She says she knows where Protasiewicz stands on issues like abortion rights, and says that's why she's voting for her. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Earlier, we heard a profile of former Justice Dan Kelly. You can read both stories and more coverage of Wisconsin Supreme Court race at WPR.org. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. When the total supply of all versions of a commercially available medication cannot meet current demand, the results can be devastating. As we hear about the extent of the problem in Wisconsin, join in anytime with your questions or thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Kruger is the Community Pharmacy Operations Manager with SSM Health. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Ariel Thurmer is the System Clinical Manager of Pharmacy Services at SSM Health. Ariel, welcome.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
David, in October, the FDA announced a shortage of immediate-release form of Adderall. This made headlines everywhere. Nearly 6 months later, the FDA says some forms of the drug remain in short supply. What's the situation with ADHD medication in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so it did start primarily with that Adderall shortage, but as you can imagine, as you know, doctors and pharmacists are looking for alternatives, you're basically pivoting all these patients away. So it's just had a trickle down effect to a lot of your, you know, alternative medications for ADHD. It's been pretty short supply for the most part.
Ariel, last week, a U.S. Senate report said drugs like children's flu medication and common antibiotics are running in short supply as well. Which other drugs in Wisconsin are pharmacists struggling to keep in stock?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, we have hundreds of meds regularly on drug shortages for healthcare are not a new thing. It's been decades of drug shortages. And sometimes it's not even the drug component itself, it's the packaging that may be short. So to say just what are the top drug shortages right now is kind of difficult. We are regularly handling drug shortages. And the big part that from pharmacy and healthcare that we want to share is, you know, it's probably a good thing that it hasn't been known that it's been decades of that. That means we were doing our jobs and preventing it from getting to the patient. I would say it's coming to light a lot more right now because we learned a lot through the pandemic and a lot of conversation around shortages around supplies and everything. So we do have other shortages. The cold and flu meds are starting to improve. We were seeing some shortages or still are feeling some shortages with our albuterol nebulizers. And again, like David alluded to, that leads to secondary shortages as we work to get patients alternatives to take care of them. But we are regularly handling shortages and trying to decrease that impact to our patients.
David, how does this even happen? I mean, hearing Ariel talk about how long you've been grappling with this is surprising. And I guess I just wonder, what are the factors that make this a thing?
Yeah, that can be, it's multifaceted, really. Ariel touched on it a little bit with, it could be something as small as the purple cap that goes on top of one of the COVID vaccine vials could be in short supply because some factory got shut down due to whatever, whether they had an issue with raw materials or not. All the way down to not being able to produce enough drug because the FDA shut down a certain production line because they found an issue with it. there's so many different reasons that it can happen. And unfortunately, it isn't new, but it is, I feel the pressure a little bit more as of late because of the pandemic. It seemed to really ramp up the number of issues. It seems to just be coming at a more rapid pace at us.
How did the COVID pandemic contribute to this, Ariel? Is it because of people not working as much, or what are those factors?
Always multifaceted there. If a line, so in manufacturing the drugs, if any of those lines that is manufacturing that drug component for us is transitioned to something else that's of higher need. So during the pandemic, a lot of the meds we needed to support our patients who were in our ICUs on ventilators, we saw a lot of different manufacturers and groups step up and say, this line can be turned over to start making this med that we know is going to be short, or making some of those raw material things that like masks, supplies, our PPE. So anytime we had to transition that area that was normally making some of these meds, that takes that back supply off the shelf. And so it was anticipated when we had to make those shifts, which were needed at the time, it was anticipated that we would have a few years. And when they anticipated the few years, they were talking like 5 to 6 years after the pandemic that we would feel this ripple effect as we started moving back into our normalcy of needing certain drug therapies for different disease states.
Wow, that long. So, David,
yeah.
America faced drug shortages before the pandemic, as we've said. You guys have been, dealing with this for a while. Sometimes we hear about it, sometimes we don't. So, David, I want to ask you, how severe is this ongoing drug shortage now? How bad are things right now?
I would say manageable for the most part. We have mitigation strategies, whether it's Ariel's team coming up with ways to preserve some of our stock for the most needy patients, or we have in our community pharmacies, we started expanding the number of wholesalers that we deal with. So if we find short supply in our primary wholesaler, we start trying to find it with secondary and tertiary wholesalers. I think the Adderall got so much light because A, you can't get a year's supply from the doc, so you have to keep getting more prescriptions from your doc. And B, we can't order that type of, that type of medication from all of our wholesalers. So some of the strategies that we have in play to help with a lot of drug shortages doesn't help us with that Adderall shortage. So I think this is why this one has gotten so much press, because it is just a little bit different.
I see. We're talking about drug shortages at Wisconsin pharmacies. Our guests are from SSM Health. David Kruger is the Community Pharmacy Operations Manager. Ariel Thurmer is the System Clinical Manager of Pharmacy Services. Be a part of this conversation by calling in with your questions or comments. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. Have you been prescribed medication only to be told it's unavailable? What happened next? Call us with your experiences and your questions about drug shortages. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Kruger is the Community Pharmacy Operations Manager with SSM Health. Ariel Thurmer is the System's Clinical Manager of Pharmacy Services at SSM Health. They stay with us. Ariel, last year, a 60 Minutes investigation found that some drug shortages are due to pharmaceutical companies stopping the production of life-saving generic drugs because they make too little profit, where they're just, we're not going to make the money. We're not going to make that medication. Are company profits a factor in the current shortages?
Yeah, I would say from a healthcare standpoint, we try not to, we probably actually don't have the time, energy, and space to really get into that too much when we're trying to manage the shortage. So a lot of times we're told the shortage is happening because the company has chose to stop making it. And instead of having to get into the why on why they've stopped, we're really more spending our energy on how to make sure our patient doesn't feel that impact and what we can do to get our other wholesalers and stock up on what we can to then get ready for transitioning to an alternative. So I think that is some valuable things that are being brought up and discussed, but from a healthcare standpoint, really when we're told the shortage is happening, we're more concerned about what we need to do to take care of the patient.
What about, I mean, do doctors know this when they're prescribing this stuff? Do they already know, hey, this drug is not going to be available, I've got to think about something else? Or does it only become evident to the patient when they go to the pharmacy and try to fill a prescription, Ariel?
Yeah, so I think that's the communication that we work really hard to do as a system. We still are working on ways to improve and optimize that. As David alluded to, we have a system team that just focuses on drug shortages. That's pharmacy and supply based. And then we work as a small team once that shortage comes in or a presumed shortage comes in to think, okay, here's the current shortage. What's the secondary shortage? Like we were talking the ripple effect with the Adderall. And then we immediately start working on communication strategies, and we have templates for how we communicate that out. We do our best to get it into the pharmacy team's hands and then to get it into our provider hands. What we find is it's really a team effort. And so if we can get it to the providers and get it to all of them before they start prescribing, that's great. But we also have found, you know, if we make sure to prepare the pharmacist or equip the pharmacist with that alternative information, it makes it easier for them to call and have that conversation with the provider. And then that is kind of a way to communicate it to the physician that the drug is short and here's your alternatives, and it's going to be short for a period of time. So we have been working as a team to script that communication and make sure to equip David's teams on the front who are patient facing.
David, let's talk about that a little bit. What happens at the pharmacy? What tools do pharmacists have for filling prescriptions when drugs are in short supply and demand remains high? Do they get these prescriptions? Do they have to, can they, are they empowered to make a substitution, or do they then need to contact the doctor? Take me through that a little bit.
Yeah, so that's, it depends on the class of medications. So a lot of medications we can make, you know, therapeutic substitutions. Unfortunately, as we started the conversation, it always kind of comes back to this Adderall. That one's deemed by the DEA it's called a Schedule II medication. So we can't really make changes on the prescription. We're going to need a new order. So basically, like Ariel said, it starts with the communication. It gives our pharmacist the tools, information, and most of the time it does result in a call to the physician's office or the provider's office. And we have started opening up, because it's been such an ongoing issue, we started opening up direct communication with our pharmacist and the providers, because SSM is such a big entity, mm-hmm. which provides us some luxuries like this, where we can have, you know, direct lines of communication with our shared platforms of technologies and things like that. So yeah, basically we get the prescription, we tell the patient that we don't have it in stock. Sometimes we even call competitive pharmacies. That is one thing that really has shined through, and I'm proud of pharmacy for in the pandemic, is we're not just caring about our bottom line, we're caring about the patient. So if we don't have it, none of our sister pharmacies have it. We do reach out to the Walgreens, the Walmarts, just to see, you know, because the first thing is to take care of the patient. We have a lot of tools in our tool belt, but primarily it does come back down to us having to reach out to that provider and work with them to get a substitution for the patient, which unfortunately does take time.
We are talking about prescription drug shortages with David Kruger and Ariel Thurmer of SSM Health. David is a community pharmacy operations manager. Ariel is the system clinical manager of pharmacy services. Ariel, are drug shortages affecting patient outcomes?
Oh, for sure. I mean, like we stated, there are alternative therapies, and we pivot to those as much as we can. We try to equip our patient-facing team members as much as possible, having those alternatives on the shelf. But I would say quality of care can sometimes be impacted when we can't move that fast enough. And then we also, you know, there are situations where, as David stated, we don't have an alternative drug, or we've used up our alternative supply already with that ripple effect, and we still aren't seeing supply back on our shelves. And in that case, that's where we really have to pivot into a mitigation strategy, which is really stating, you know, these are the patients at highest need for the drug that we have available. And then, you know, these patients, we may have to try some different supportive care. And we really do our best to not get to that point. And our, again, we work as a collaborative team. It's all hands on deck when we get to that point with a drug shortage. But there are definitely points where we are micromanage some of these drug shortages when it gets to the point that the primary shortage and alternatives are no longer on our shelves.
Ariel, do you see any potential action that lawmakers could take either on the state or federal level that could help reduce these drug shortages?
I think this is a huge part of just getting the word out there. Like I said, we've been doing this for decades, and we were, I would say, healthcare is proud that, you know, maybe it didn't hit the forefront because it meant our patients were able to get care. But as we continue to talk about this and bring awareness to drug shortages, I think it does help our political teams know that that is an area that we really do need support. From the healthcare standpoint, I don't necessarily have the answer to what they should or shouldn't be saying on those for the political piece, but we do have healthcare teams do go out and talk with our legislative groups. And so when we are advocating for support with law changes, now they know what we're talking about, you know, why it is a concern when we say, you know, we're not able to get this drug on the shelf. So just being able to bring awareness to the drug shortages and that we are able to speak to them and share the things that we have been doing, I feel is already making it a higher item for them to ask more questions about.
David, in the last 15, 20 seconds we have in our time together, what would you advise patients who are affected by these shortages?
Ask questions, show patience, and just be prepared that a lot of times you're not going to have as fast of a trip to the pharmacy as you may have had 2 years ago, unfortunately. But yeah, I would say patience and communication with your pharmacist and your provider is key.
I want to thank you both for joining us and sharing this information. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Yes, thank you for having us. We appreciate it. Have a great day.
Yes, thank you.
David Kruger is the Community Pharmacy Operations Manager with SSM Health. Ariel Thurmer is the System Clinical Manager of Pharmacy Services there. I am Shireen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.